Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
It was just honestly trying to just kind of going after that and, you know, taking, you know, each vintage is like a new Christmas. Right,
I love that analogy.
You open that bottle, right, that you've driven the cork into. And I'm also guilty of, people say, how long do you let your wines rest? I'm that guy that will tear the cork out 45 minutes after we put it in, and then I'll taste it young. And I love young wines, and I love old wines. Mm-hmm. But I was just going after, honestly, just what can this hill bring to it? And something that has always stuck with me is hillside grapes, mountaintop grapes, typically pretty standard, smaller clusters, smaller berries in those clusters. Valley floor, wonderful fruit comes from valley floor. We know there's some great vineyards down there, a lot of great vineyards. A lot of them are not so great, and a lot of them, you know, they're allowed to produce and overcrop, so they're setting too much fruit, and the fruit oftentimes gets, the berries get blown up to a large size because the access, the vine has such easy access to a very high water table in the valley.
Yeah.
So they don't shut down real well, and they want to keep pumping water into the grapes. Well, up here, we've got to water to get the grapes to survive. On a mountaintop, all the water runs away from you. So you water just to get the vines to live. And a vine to survive will put out a small crop of small berries. Well, if you go with that, all the flavors on this from the skin of the grape, the smaller the grape, the higher the juice to skin ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have more naturally higher occurring flavors and extractions and tannins and deep color. You know, we've never had to worry about adding some type of color to our wine to get it dark. It already comes out like India ink, you know, so we've never had to worry about that. And all that comes from being up in the hills. So I've always believed that it is so much about place. So much, you know, there was an argument many, many years ago. Actually, Bob Begoff was being interviewed for an article, and they would ask me questions on the side, and they said, you know, what do you think about where the grapes are grown? I said, I think it's really everything. And I think Bob's argument was, well, a great winemaker can make great wine anywhere. And we had this ongoing argument that went on. I said, I think a great winemaker can certainly do a great job with inferior fruit. And I said, there'll be those times, but I said, really great wines will never be built or made from, you know, a bad location, from bad fruit.
And I think you touched upon it actually earlier when you said you can tweak it in the cellar, you can correct mistakes, you can mask it, particularly with respect to full-bodied red varietals. And you can't do that with Pinot, my understanding is. But what you can't fix is what came into your cellar. So when they say it starts in the vineyard, I know it's become a cliche comment, but it doesn't make it any less valuable.
It's dead on true.
It's 100%.
It's 100%. And it really does. And I've, you know, Niall has taken that, something that, you know, I am no genius, but I've made some good moves. And one of them was to tie my winemaker into the field. Rather than just, and I think this, why would you say have to be the sole caretaker of the vines just to have these grapes, give them to your winemaker, and have them go, well, gee, if, you know, if they were done this, if they had sat out here, or if it had been cropped this way. So I early on tied Niall to the farming side. What it does also, there's not a whole lot of excuses you could have for how it's grown when you tie your winemaker into that.
Yeah.
But you also give him the ability to, unquestionably, grow the grapes the way he wants to have them delivered to the winery. And that's such a natural. So when I see these private farming companies farming to deliver fruit to a winemaker, why wouldn't you have those guys tied together?
You know, this is actually a seminal point, and I really want to highlight it because I have spoken to so many viticulturalists, some very famous ones that work with tons of winemakers, and they would be the first to admit it, that if the winemaker doesn't come around and check on the fruit, and really get engaged and just shows up at harvest, that's a different sort of thing. And you can draw your own conclusions from that. The point is that if the winemaker's not a vineyardist, I'm not so sure that's a good thing.
Now that I've come all these years and I've been able to see this and see the results of this,
yeah.
I'd never do it any other way.
Yeah.
We are the only people on Pritchard Hill. We are our own farming company and have been from the start.
Very cool.
Everyone else has custom farmers. And
yeah.
These guys, they do great jobs. They can plow a beautiful vineyard and it's gorgeous. But also when it comes time for harvest,
yeah.
And this is a key point why you want to have your own farming company. Typically a custom farmer will give you, you know, and if you're an exceptional winery, they will give you 2 to 3 days, different days, maybe even 4 days of picking all your fruit. Because they've also got many other ranches that
absolutely.
So they're trying to slot you into this date, this date, and this date. When you have your own company, we have had as many as 47 different picks from our vineyard.
My God.
Because our winemaker will say, let's go get half of this row, let's go get two halves of this row over here, pick this one row on top. And so each day before harvest, he flags this with stop, with flags that tell us where to stop. So he can, on one day he can say, no, there won't be any picking today. By 2:30 that afternoon or 3 o'clock, he can say, we're picking today. And of course we do all our picking at night.
Yeah.
The fruit is fresh. But that's how fast we were able to move. If he says, he can say that there's nothing coming, and then all of a sudden he changes mind, we'll go get it.
That's really extraordinary. That's a luxury that very few.
It's why I'll never give up farming.
Afford.
I'll never give up doing our own farming.
It really shows up in the final product. So when somebody buys your bottled wine, it's really as good as it can get.
It's, I always tell you, soup to nuts. I mean, growing to bottling, it's all done right here.
Wow, this is a far more complete picture than even I was aware of. That, there's no detail left.
No.
A chance. Viticulturally speaking, they had to have been such meaningful changes in... the 40 years, it's kind of a scary number, as I say it. I mean,
it is.
It's hard to absorb, but it's also an exponential process. When you first came here and you were digging basically through the pile of rocks that I understand can be seen from space when you pile them all together.
Oh, yeah.
So not exactly friendly conditions, but that soil is such a great... it's unlike anything else, I understand. And there's little vines that struggle, and like you said, for survival and a start, they work really pretty hard.
They do.
So how has your viticultural, just give us an overview, changed from the time that you first planted Chardonnay and then, of course, transitioning to the red grapes? What happened?
Well, so I learned early on that I wasn't the guy that wanted to put on a space suit and spray things. And actually,
yeah.
I got a lot of this from old farmers. People that I would talk to, I can remember before I was even planting my vineyard,
mm-hmm.
There was the old guard that went with this. It was called St. George rootstock. That's
right.
Kind of known throughout the valley. And then along in the late 70s came this rootstock AXR. And it was to be hailed as, the new... equal quality St. George, if not better, and production was much higher. And of course, as a farmer, which is what I thought I would be just doing as farming, I never saw myself in the wine business. I certainly wanted to go for, as much production as I could get. So
sure.
I remember I was at the Oakville Farm Station, University of California at Oakville Station.
Yeah.
And there was a lecture going on there in the field, and of course it was the classic easel with the big piece of the paper, and he would draw, if you plant AXR you can get this tonnage. And as I was leaving this lecture, there was a classic old farmer, and he's walking out to his car next to me, and he says, so Sonny, what are you going to do? What are you going to plant in your vineyard? Because I was getting ready, I was trying to make a decision, which one of these I go with, St. George or AXR. And he said, which one are you going to go with? And I said, well, that AXR looks pretty good. I said, extra tonnage. I said, and the quality seems to be rated the same. I said, I think I'm going AXR. And he said, can I tell you something? I said, sure, what? He says, I've been doing this a long time. I've seen things like this come and go. He says, I'll tell you what you do. You plant good old St. George. And it was that moment that changed me. And I planted St. George. And I avoided the whole fiasco with phylloxera, because it turned out that AXR was not resistant to phylloxera, and it wound up eating all these vines in Napa Valley, and I would have had to replant, which would have probably broke me.
Wow.
So it was stuff like that that I lucked out on. You know, going forward in farming practices, I can remember a vineyard that I was at, and I won't name it, that it was full of like white flies. We'd be in there picking grapes, and these clouds of these flies would fly in your face and in your nose and eyes. It was crazy. And someone said, oh, you know, we need to get some spray in here and knock out these flies. Well, evidently they had been spraying for them, or something else, and they killed something else that brought in more of these white flies, and if you kill white flies, then it brings stuff. And it was, I saw, you know, it was really right in front of me. It was before this whole, before too much ecology had been in the approach, had really gotten investigative into this. And I saw that, wow, you kill this, you get more of this, you kill this. So I decided from day one that we would never spray a pesticide here, and we never have. There's never been a pesticide. So we've been certified organic since 1987.
Wait, before it was a trendy word?
Before it was, yeah.
You know, it's so funny. We humans we're kind of very arrogant in the sense that we think that we can avoid the law and intended consequences. And somehow you had the foresight early on to be very thoughtful about how you treated your land and your vineyard.
And you know what? I think if it was something somebody just told me about or that I read about, I would certainly consider it. But I saw it firsthand. I saw it in a vineyard. I saw a vineyard out of balance. You know, the quail weren't there to eat the little bugs that would, you know, that would be in the vine.
That ecosystem that's totally symbiotic.
Yes.
That makes sense to you because you've witnessed it so much.
So every year we put down, I don't know, it's maybe 150 pounds of organic compost every year. We lay it out. It's expensive to do, but we do it. And it makes for, I think, you know, lets me sleep at night. I can feel good about what goes into wines and,
So you don't really talk about that a whole lot. I haven't read,
it's become second place with us. It's just something that we do.
It's assumed consent. It's something that you've just incorporated into your practices, and you don't feel the need to highlight it in your marketing materials.
No.
Thank you for doing this, because so many speak to that and it became a marketing term, which is really a shame, because a consumer that's looking at a bottle of wine should have the cues to discern where to spend their hard-earned money. And the fact that you literally put your money where your mouth is. You treat your vineyard literally like it's your own, like you would, you know, give this grapes to your kids.
Absolutely.
That's how you are.
It's it.
And that's so important. So you guys, if you're already buying the wine, you know probably, but even if you don't, I'm sure you feel even better about it. Those that don't, whether they buy your brand or somebody else's, please do your research. You know, find out farming practices, not from the glossy marketing piece, but ask questions. You go to a grocery store, like so many of us these days, you know, we want Whole Foods, whether it's not just a name brand, but we want to eat, you know, in a more holistic, wholesome way. So we care about, you know, the bananas we buy and tomatoes, but what about wine? I mean, that's a major expense. So if you really say that you care about that, that's how you demonstrate it. You buy from producers that do the right thing.
No, thank you. You're right.
You've literally seen this hill grow up. I feel like this podcast should be titled The Sage of the Sage Canyon, but literally. I feel like you have so much wisdom, you know, and you've observed for...
It's school of hard knocks. I mean, I you look at it now and it could be painted, looks like that, but it's, you know, there's a time, I mean, there's so many cycles in wine, and it seems like about every 6 or 7 years, the wine market would go into a big dip. And there was the one of 08, you know, when the market, you know, all our whole financial market just tanked.
Yeah, it was awful.
And I will tell you that no one wanted to buy a bottle of wine then. Matter of fact, people that represented us that were out in the market selling our wine were told by the wine buyers from restaurants, don't even bring me a bottle of wine that's more than $30 because the public will not buy it.
Ouch.
And so I was left with this deal, like, what do you do? My wine is more expensive than that. You know, these farming practices, these ways, it's expensive to do
it. It's a real cost. It's not just you and Napa Valley. No. It's a real bottom line.
Yeah. So I didn't know what to do. You know, again, I'm not a marketing genius. And there was an advertisement for United Airlines, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it goes something like this. There was, they're all around a conference table. And the CEO is at the head of the conference table, and he stands up and he says, Susan, no more faxes, no more emails. You're going to go to St. Louis and see Jim. And here's a ticket. He hands him an envelope. Of course, it has tickets, but this ad's for United Airlines, right? And then he says, you know, Barbara, you're going to go see Sam in Florida. You know, no more faxes. And I was seeing this advertisement. I don't know if you remember. Do you remember that?
No. Nope.
Okay.
But I'm hanging on to every word.
It was plain.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how it was affecting me and about what I needed to have done. I needed to sell wine. And so I woke up in the middle of one night, as I do. I sleep for a few hours.
I get a sense. I remember the 3 a.m. 70 glass tastings. I was picturing it in my mind.
It's still that way.
Oh, God.
So, and for whatever reason, if I have any rest at all, and when I do come alive at midnight, there's no getting back to it because so much stuff gets in my head. And I realized that I'd been seeing this ad and it had a real subliminal effect on me. And I thought, that's what we're going to do. We've never been around the country to say hello to our distributors. They've been selling our wine for years. They've never even seen me. They don't know who I am. And I came up with this idea to get a rock and roll tour bus.
Oh my God.
And tour the country and go and take it to every one of these distributors, get them out of their cubicles, get them on board the bus. The bus held 27 people on board. And so when I first came up with this idea, and brought it back to the winery, and my two daughters that were both working with me at the time, I can remember my older daughter said, Dad, that is such a ghetto idea. She goes, that's terrible. You're going to wreck the name David Arthur. And of course, I thought it, and I said, no, I won't. And I went away from that. I felt horrible. And I thought, you know what? What's happened is I just haven't packaged my approach to them correctly. Mm-hmm. I have to market this better to them before they can get behind it and market it. So I came back, got 2 weeks later. I said, you know what? Listen to me. I said, what about this tour bus idea again? But what if it's wrapped in this great wrapper? It says Maritaggio. And mm-hmm. And then my daughter bought into it. And then she took off on it and said, okay, it'll be like a rock and roll tour bus.
That's right.
We'll have the tour dates on the back of the bus, right? We'll have TV screens inside, and then we said you can Skype to the bus, and people that get on board the bus can look at screens and talk to Niall, our winemaker, in real time. And so this thing just caught fire, right? So I was on the road for 3 years. I did each year I would do 170 nights on the road, and it was crazy. So people would pass me. And they thought that maybe a rock and roll person was on the bus, right?
Oh, there was.
And no, there was not. It was me.
Wine, rock and roll.
So I would travel like this, and I would always stay at sleep inns. You know, they were like $75 to $80
sleep
a night. It was cheap, and actually, they always had space for buses. You could bring buses there. They had bus parking space, so it would help out, but. I can remember this one night. This was typical of the kind of stuff that would happen. I'd get done with a late night winemaker dinner somewhere where the bus would be at the dinner.
Sure.
And so then I'd leave there and go back to a sleep in. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these reservations too were made a little on the fly. I'd get back mm-hmm. on and call back to the winery or call Laura or call my wife, and they'd make reservations on the fly from California, make a reservation someplace in Missouri, wherever the hell I was. So I pull into the Sleep Inn, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm under their porte-cochere, and I go into the reservation desk, and this young kid is there, and he's got a very serious look on his face. And I said, everything okay with you? And he said, yeah, I think so. And I said, well, you seem like something's bothering you. And he had seen this bus pull up, the tour bus pull up, and it was on his TV cameras. And it was pretty imposing. And he said, you guys aren't going to trash the room, are you?
Oh, that's priceless.
I said back to him, I said, you know what? We don't do that anymore.
Oh, my God. You are something else.
But it was this type of stupid stuff. And so it was back to that guerrilla marketing. It took me right back to the days of, 1986 with my wife and selling wine like that.
Yeah.
To hitting the road, saying hello to everybody. And it kind of had three different levels. I would get people out of their cubicles that a lot of these people, they would never even visit Napa Valley.
Of course.
Now they could see videos of Napa Valley, talk to someone, ask any winemaking questions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then I would... Remember, Sean, whose office we're in right now, Sean, he met me on the bus. Mm-hmm. I was in Charleston, South Carolina, where Sean was living there. Mm-hmm. And I had the bus actually in a Whole Foods parking lot. Because one of the things I would do was get the bus in a parking lot. And I would invite all the restaurateurs and the retailers to say, join me at like 2:30 or 3 o'clock, before they went on their shifts.
Yeah.
Join me at the bus for a glass of wine. And I would have cheeses cut up and, some salamis and things. And matter of fact, I'd go into that Whole Foods where I would get my cheese cut up for me. And one of the girls is cutting up the cheese and she says, can you tell me who's on that bus? And I said, certainly you can appreciate the security that surrounds these people. And she goes, you can't tell me. I said, I'd love to tell you. I cannot tell you. And I got my cheese and got back in the bus. But anyway, Sean happened to be in the parking lot and saw Napa Valley Maritaggio. And at the time, he was selling wine for the Chapelet Winery. And so we thought, wait a minute, David Arthur, they're neighbors of Chapelet. So he came and knocked on the door of the bus. He came in, and that was how I met Sean. But, yeah, the stuff you do,
There's a huge teachable moment here, so I don't want to gloss over that. Marketing is such a dominating discussion. I certainly spend a fair portion of my life talking about wine marketing, and I'm not even in the business, but it's just such an overshadowing thing because there's so much good wine. You pointed out that everybody's step up that game.
If you don't come out of something different, you have a long road to hoe. I'm the same guy that, this goes back to, now it's been probably 10 years ago, that my wife and my stepdaughter were talking in the kitchen, and I couldn't get their attention to save my life, so I lit a pack of firecrackers and I threw it in the kitchen sink, and firecrackers went everywhere. One went straight up and burned our ceiling. And,
Sure Bob, you loved that.
Everybody scattered. Like, my wife came back and saw the burn in the ceiling. She goes, you know, what you're doing to the value of the home, burnt ceiling.
Yeah.
And so I climbed up on the kitchen island and I had a Sharpie and I signed it. And I said, maybe this will do nothing. Maybe one day it'll be something, but. It's still dated to this day. You can go in the kitchen and see the burn mark, and I dated it and signed it. And stupid stuff.
Hardly. You were talking about the old timers that you were talking to,
yeah.
Where you gleaned all this wisdom. Are you talking to anybody about any of this? Because you have a lot of value to add just from your experience. Are you mentoring people?
Actually, I do. And to this extent, I never look at myself as... like a killer mentor. But what I do try and do is this. new people that are getting into the business.
Yeah.
New wine, whether it's, you know, winemakers or someone that's come out with a wine label.
Yeah.
And they don't know that much about the business. I learned this. It's so crazy. I learned it in the restaurant business. As you climb this ladder in life, and as you reach up for the next rung on the ladder,
yeah,
to reach down and bring that next winemaker up, you don't have to have this all to yourself. It doesn't have to be all about your wine. So I'll do a lot of winemaker dinners where it could just be a David Arthur, but I pull someone else in. Matter of fact, there's been a couple. Ryan Hill was one, Hill Family, and then another buddy of mine. Dean Gray that has River Rain. Ryan Hill, to his credit, one of the years I was traveling on the bus, I'm on the buses coming into Texas, and he knew about my bus travels, and he called me on the bus and didn't know me. He said, "David, this is Ryan Hill." He said, "I met you once a few years ago." And I said, "Oh yeah, I remember you." He said, "Is there any way that I could travel with you on the bus for a few days?" And I thought, I could have said no, and it would have been understood. You know, actually, no, Ryan, I'm kind of busy with things, and that's not really, I could have said that.
Yeah.
But instead, I said, come on.
Yeah.
And so I picked him up, and he was on the bus with me for 4 or 5 days. And in those 4 or 5 days, I had David Arthur winemaker dinners, and I made it a David Arthur Hill Family winemaker dinner. And I've always learned doing this. People think, oh, you take away from your brand, or there'll be less wine bought of David Arthur because you're splitting this with someone else. But the net effect is really that more, a bigger group knows about all of you. And at the end of the day, it can't just be about yourself.
Tide lifts all boats.
High tide lifts all boats.
Where do those values come from? I'm hearing a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion. That's just how you approach everyone. And generosity. Where does it come from?
I never want anyone to have, you know, all the tough times that I had. I mean, it was tough, and I went through a lot of times of barely making it. Heidi Barrett and I used to laugh, and if you talk to her, we kind of agreed between the two of us this would never be talked about. But since it was really my problem, I mean, she would probably admit to it if you talked to her. But when things were going really bad, there was a little box heater that we had down in the lab that would heat it up for us so we could work down there. And I told her one day, I said, "I feel like turning that heater towards the wall and just letting this place burn." And we've laughed about it a lot since then. And all you have to do is say, "Heater against the wall," and she'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh my God, that's such great currency. If she won't do an interview with me, I know how to get her attention. Wow. These are the...
It just tests me. So, you know, if I can help someone that's new and invite them to a dinner and get their brand known.
How cool would that be? Everybody talks about changing the world and have grandiose ideas about it. How about just helping one person?
It's easy to do. Do a joint winemaker dinner. Winemakers that are listening, grab a buddy that's in this business. You know, you have a lot of them. Grab them. Do a joint dinner. Even 3 of you together. Also, you know what? You're going to draw from a bigger crowd.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And you're going to have a lot of fun, too. That's the thing. Playing off each other at these things is a lot of fun. You all have stories on each other. You know, someone's got a little bit of dirt here, a little bit of dirt there. And it makes... Your audience...
Yes.
Become so much more excited. I have this rule. I've developed this rule, and I've had this now for, I say, within 10 years. I don't know if it's 10, 12 years. But my rule is this. When I'm speaking to a group, no speaker has the right to get a group of people in a room, get the door closed, and bore them. You know, your hair better be on fire. You better have, because these people deserve not just your great wine, but they deserve a great experience.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.